Hello and welcome to the Lebanese Politics Podcast. My name is Benjamin Red, joined as always by Nizar Hassan. Nizar, voting has begun.
Yeah, it's crazy. It happened so fast. I mean, I really remember the announcements of the candidates and the list. Like, it's yesterday, you know? All these weeks are just passing.
It is going so, so very fast right now. So voting has already begun. Today, Friday, polls opened for expats in 10 countries, mostly in the Gulf. And then on Sunday, there's going to be other expats voting. The majority of the expats are going to be voting on Sunday. And then next Thursday, we have poll workers going to the polls. And then next Sunday, we have the big in-person election here in Lebanon. It's time. The elections have begun.
Yeah, the elections are a bit weird this time because there's been a lot of expectations and talk about the elections for more than a couple of years now. But then again, the excitement isn't really there apart from specific, circles or diaspora groups or certain people working in, electoral machines and stuff. But overall, you don't see the same energy that we used to see in previous elections. I can tell you that for sure. On the streets, and people's behaviors, how many people are going to political events, etc. It's not it's dominating the social environment in Lebanon. I don't think so, right?
Right. I would agree with that. And part of the reason for that probably is just this sense of, what difference is it going to make? And part of it also is probably due to, the boycott or the withdrawal, rather, of Saad Hariri and the Future Movement that has caused a lot of Sunni voters to question why should we even go to the polls if our guy isn't on the ticket.
Yeah, and a lot of people who don't even support one specific political zaim are demotivated by how confusing it is to be making a political choice between so many lists in each district, It's not like you have a clear political choice wherever you are. There are very few districts that have only two or three lists, two or three alliances. No, you have a bunch of lists with a bunch of figures and everyone's trying to tell you, I'm the change, I'm the opposition, etc. So this podcast, as we have been saying for the last 2 weeks, is here to help you make sense of all of that. And in the first episode of the podcast, of this limited series before the elections, what we did was kind of describe what has been happening, the depth of the economic and political crisis that we are in today, based on the developments that have occurred in Lebanon in the last few years, including the October 17 uprising, the port explosion, but also the political stalemate and the economic collapse and financial collapse. In last week's episode, we focused on how these political actors, ruling actors and opposition groups, are approaching this election in terms of alliances and strategy primarily. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about what they are saying. We spent more time talking about who they are lying with and which money interests or other economic interests are involved. So this time, it's time to talk about discourse, rhetoric, how these parties are approaching this moment and mobilizing people.
Right. Not all of these parties see the problem the same way. In fact, there's vastly different views on this subject and also just as many a diversity of solutions. And I feel, though, yet again, we're running into this issue, though, of it's so complicated. There are so many actors. We're not going to be able to go through every single, Gibran Basile said this, and then so-and-so said, instead, we're going to try to piece together sort of strands that are commonalities.
Exactly. It's an episode where we do analysis based on what we can observe in terms of what brings certain discourses together and where they diverge primarily. And one of the main components of any political discourse, especially in a time of crisis, is, as we said, how it frames the problem. What does it see as the main problem in Lebanon? And when we're talking about identifying the problem or framing it, we're also talking about, responsibilities, who's to blame for what, your relationship as a political actor to the problem. Are you part of it or are you part of the solution? Or is it somewhere between the two? As we will see, it's quite interesting and nuanced this time, especially because of how deep the crisis is.
Right. So as you mentioned in the first episode, we sort of laid the groundwork. We know, there was this huge economic collapse in the country. The Thawra broke out, which was aimed at the Zuma as being completely incapable of dealing with Lebanon's problems. But if you are one of these traditional political parties or some party that has had power in the past, how exactly do you square yourself with that sentiment of, oh, you know, kilun yani kilun, all of these guys are bad and they need to get out? Say, you know, if you are the LF, for instance, you have been in power, though you do style yourself as opposition and outside of things. You're running again. So how then do you describe the problem without implicating yourself? And so what we see from the Lebanese forces, since we started out with this example, you know, really the line is, yes, huge economic collapse. But fundamentally, what this all comes down to is, well, we don't have a state because Hezbollah and Iran have taken over the country. And the root cause of all of this is a lack of sovereignty because of these actors. And this is a very popular line that's shared not just by the LF, but I think a lot of people, especially in the Christian electorate, share this sense.
Yeah, but like, it's always important to remember that in 2019, when the Intifada was actually happening, Samir Jarjar's discourse was completely different. He was saying, it's not time to talk about Hezbollah's weapons now. We need to focus on the real needs of the Lebanese people. But then, as you get closer to a political opportunity like the elections, a serious political opportunity of actually reaching power, then everything becomes about your enemy and how important it is to close ranks and fight the enemy, rather than identifying the problems in a way that distributes blame in a fair way or in a logical way. So as you said, yeah, this... Come on, Ritalin.
You're keeping that line in, right?
So as you said, yeah, there's the LF carrying this discourse, but you also see it among other actors. One phenomenon that we see is kind of like March 14 figures trying to come back up and carry this, the anti-Hezbollah fight, you know. And you see here people like Faris Saied, who is, you know, very determined to say that we are under an Iranian occupation. Some people, I don't think a lot of people believe this kind of line, because it's not very realistic in terms of like, what does occupation really mean in that situation?
Right, compared to, say, the Syrian occupation, if you're saying, oh, Iran is occupying the country, you have to sort of justify that with something else, because clearly, I mean, it's not the same thing.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Syrian regime or Israeli occupation or the occupations we have seen in our history are, you know,
real.
Are real. Yeah. The role of carrying arms and fighting the enemy has almost never been a monopoly for the state, let's be honest. And since the civil war, since the end of the civil war till today, there has been this one big question about Hezbollah's weapons and what to do about them. And it's a serious discussion. It's not a stupid discussion.
Right. There's a reason why this line is so popular. And it's not just because of some, you know, wild conspiracy theorists or something like that. There is something to it, right?
Definitely. Like any other rhetoric, right? Because Hezbollah, instead of supporting the uprising or its demands, it came out and said, look, maybe you have good intentions, some of you, but this is a conspiracy. And this uprising is associated with this and that embassy and this and that country. And then actually, you know, confronting these protesters on the ground through violent means, Hezbollah put itself at the forefront of the ruling establishment's reaction to the uprising. And because of how important the uprising was as a moment in our political history, it was a moment where a lot of people's ideas were being formed very quickly. For the first time, they're discussing politics with everyone, with their siblings, their parents, their friends, their partners. And Hezbollah taking that position alienated it from a lot of people who kind of realized that, okay, there is no way to build a proper country in the presence of such an actor, because simply we're not as powerful and this actor can impose its political will on us.
Right. For the people in the streets in those first few days, there was a question, actually, well, which way is Hezbollah going to go? They genuinely didn't know. But then Hassan Nasrallah came out and made clear that essentially Hezbollah was not join these protests and eventually, come out against them quite heavily. And essentially that was seen by a lot of the people in the streets as, okay, well, that's Hezbollah basically protecting the political class, protecting Nabi Berri, Michel Aoun, Saad Hariri, all of these people.
Exactly. So now the rhetorics we see about that range from all of them are to blame and that's it, to all of them are to blame, but Hezbollah specifically because it's an armed group that is protecting the establishment. And then you go to the LF and March 14 discourse, Michel Maouad, Kataeb, Jabhat al-Mu'arada, Taqaddum, these people. Sovereignty first, meaning all of these other problems you're talking about, economic and political problems, are important, but it's really fundamentally an issue of sovereignty and an issue of Hezbollah's presence. And on this spectrum, you might find almost anyone, except for, obviously, Hezbollah allies. But what brings all of these discourses together is the idea that you started with, which is corrupt political establishment is the problem. It's all about whether you think Hezbollah dominates the establishment or is the real like power behind the establishment or not. You fall on one of these lines of the spectrum. What these discourses generally don't take into account so much is the deep crisis in the economic model, you know, beyond the normal talking points. Oh, we don't have a productive economy. We have a rentier economy. Yeah, breaking news.
Which is, nothing new. It's been said for decades now.
And even if you say something like power sharing is not effective or there's too much corruption and sectarian allocations of things, you're still saying the basics, the self-evident things that no one will ever argue against. The problem with this discourse, they kind of stay at the surface in the sense of we have basically bad politicians rather than a fundamentally bad system. It's about who represents you in the state in terms of better people, more competent people, cleaner, less corrupt people, you know, rather than our capitalist model is bullshit, it doesn't work, our economic financial model is absolutely unsustainable, and it has collapsed because it doesn't work, and we need a very new perspective on that, and also the political system is bad and we need to change it. I'm jumping ahead here, but just to say how different the discourse can be between changing the faces or bringing in new blood and actually changing the system.
Right. So on one side of the equation, you sort of have this, let's change the faces, get some new blood in, that sort of a thing. Better people, less corrupt people. And then on the other side, you have deeper changes. But then there's also, and I think this goes more into the first category, although it doesn't quite fit, is what is Hezbollah's response to all of this? They're running in the elections too, right? You know, obviously they do not think that they are the problem. They do recognize that there's a problem. Obviously, nobody can deny that. They don't seem to focus on it as much in their rhetoric. It doesn't seem. It's not that they're denying it necessarily. But instead, they tend to point the finger at, oh, well, the United States or the Gulf, Israel, these kinds of things, especially, the United States with its sanctions, they're suffocating us, has such, control of the banks and has such inroads in the banks that, they're the real problem here. And here you do have a bit of the discussion of the banks, which is maybe not as emphasized in certain other rhetoric, coming from the sovereigntist movement, the sort of March 14th people writ large.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to Hezbollah, there are mainly two problems, but it's one big thing. It's a foreign conspiracy against the resistance in Lebanon and against Hezbollah and its allies. They have some valid talking points in this discourse, like the fact that the Americans are very biased in their sanctions, for example. However, what they fail to do quite clearly, I think, is to explain really, in reality, how this supposed siege on Lebanon works. Like, really? Are we really not allowed to, get things from abroad? Are we really not allowed to get financial support? You know, it doesn't sound very honest, because it doesn't look like a siege situation.
I think maybe the one thing that does maybe hit home more is, all of the noise about, you have to sanction Qardal Hassan, for instance, which does actually affect people on the ground.
Yeah, and There is a conspiracy against Hezbollah. This is not the question. The question is it really a conspiracy, or is this just that you are on two different sides of the political axis and you are fighting each other, each with their own tools? Like,
right. The U.S. doesn't exactly make it a secret, you know, like they listed Hezbollah as a terrorist organization and said, hey, no, we're coming after you. And that's been borne out by, you know, the past 20 years of Lebanese history, too.
I think what makes it more convincing now, which is also a valid talking point, is that there are many countries, many new actors that have joined this U.S.-Israeli axis in a way or another. Most recently, the UAE and a list of Arab countries doing normalization with Israel under the sponsorship of the United States in return for material reward or land, depending on the country.
Land?
Yeah, Morocco. So there is an actual, you know, there is a huge movement for like normalization, ending this whole, you know, Palestinian rights for liberation thing. Like, you know, let's try to kind of move forward in the sense, in the very dangerous sense of moving forward, which is forgetting about the injustices and accepting them. So in that sense, Hezbollah is being targeted by its usual enemies and by some new actors that kind of rose in the last 10 years to fight this Hezbollah influence or Iran influence primarily in the region, which are Gulf nations. However, in terms of on the ground in Lebanon, it's very hard to understand the kind of how this discourse is causing the economic and financial social collapse, you know, that we see today. You know, are you really, can you really explain everything through this line of discourse? You can't. So what it kind of slides into is this sense of cynical realism, which says, unless there is a big change, we can't control the situation. So we don't blame the banks specifically. We don't blame a specific political actors. We blame LF and people who hate us and want to take away our weapons. Of course, we blame them for potential civil war before it happens, of course. But they don't spend their time blaming politicians like, oh, Hariri did this bad. No, it's about like, this country is a tricky situation and we're doing as much as possible, but it's all outside of control. There's something bigger happening on the region, international level, that determines what happens in Lebanon.
And as far as what needs to change here in Lebanon, there certainly isn't any sort of push for some sort of systemic change. In fact, Nasrallah has ruled that out. It's very much in line with the idea of, okay, well, we need maybe some fresh ideas and we need to do some stuff. We need to protect small depositors. We need to fight corruption. That's a big talking point as well. But there's no push to say, oh no, that like the fundamental, you know, the system's fundamentally broken and we need to make massive constitutional changes or massive changes to the economic system at this point.
Yeah. When Hezbollah says we are trying, but we are doing well, but we cannot, you know, force others to do the same, it's implying a certain thing, which is Lebanon cannot be ruled by one side. We are just, you know, one sect, and we have to take into account that there are other sects, and therefore it's not in our hands, you know, to impose our will. So it's a hint at the fact that the Lebanese system just doesn't work because there is no political party that can rule. This is the second line of this, the third or the second main line of discourse, which is Lebanese system is dysfunctional, deeply dysfunctional. It doesn't work. And here you see a range of discourses as well. You see, for example, this implied idea in Hezbollah's discourse that we wish we could, you know, like bang our hand on the table and say, this is how things go, but this is Lebanon and we will go to a civil war and we're not willing to go there. But then you have the FPM, who has been in power as the most Christian political party. What does that even mean? But then you have the FPM, who has been in power in most governments with the largest share for years and years and years. But its discourse is not like to say, no, we weren't in power or anything like that. It's to say, no one can be in power in this current system because no matter the number of seats you own in parliament or cabinet, you're still subjected to this consociational democracy thing, and everyone can make, basically can veto any decision of yours based on their interests, and therefore nothing can be achieved. This is the primary line of discourse of the FPM and Jubran Bassil today.
Which is quite realistic.
It's totally true.
Right.
Like, regardless,
especially
of saying,
post-Doha. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Since 2008, Lebanon has been ruled by totally consensual in the sense of literally needing the consensus of almost everyone for almost anything. This is absolutely crazy. No country ever works this way. So Gibran Basile or Sharb el-Nahas saying it, not a big difference. They're saying the same thing. But what is different between this these two discourses, for example, is that, for example, Sharb el-Nahas is not saying like just that the Lebanese system doesn't work. He's saying that the zu'ama, the six zu'ama who are ruling over the system, because of how bad the system they have created is for their own interest, to advance their own interests, to buy political loyalty, to do all of these things, and how they distributed powers among them, they have created something that they cannot even rule over in terms of they cannot achieve anything. And their discourse is more focused on the idea that there is no real state in Lebanon. And this is the big problem, like the lack of state. Politically, ideologically, political theory-wise, basically, it's very debatable. What does it mean to say there is no state? But if you live in Lebanon, you kind of understand what they're trying to say intuitively, because there is no like certain notions such as rule of law or equality between citizens or things like that are so far from like your daily reality. You know, this is not how things happen in Lebanon. So it's the idea that there is no state or where is the state is very common, you know.
And I remember hearing that back when I first got to Lebanon in 2009. Where is the state at? This is not a new thing.
Definitely not. But within also opposition movements that talk about how the system doesn't work, there's sometimes more focus on the, for example, the class aspect of it, or who controls the state and how they make it work in their own interest, rather than saying there is no state in Lebanon, which is Memphis' discourse. But what brings together the FPM and the Thawra, ironically, is that both of them are clearly saying the continuation of sectarian consociationalism as it's going does not work, therefore we need change. Amal, like Birri, always says we need to get rid of sectarianism and all of that. But, you know,
coming from him.
I mean, Basile reached the peak of his power and then understood that, the Lebanese system doesn't work, we need to change it. But, you know, Basile is, what, like 15 years old in Lebanese, real Lebanese politics? Birri has been manufacturer of the system. He's been ruling over this state aspect of sectarianism and distribution and all of these things for a while. He was a main guy in every single kind of primary alliance that has ruled Lebanon, except times where March 14 had governments and March 8 were in opposition. But most of the time, Birri is the main key player, and he's been, you know, Speaker of Parliament since 92 for that reason. So it's a different, when Basile and Birri are saying it, it's not exactly the same thing. Birri is the don of the mafia, you know, in everyone's minds. It's not like, is he performing right well enough or not, you know? No, it's like, I don't care what shit he's done. If he's supporting me in my local village doing this or that project, or I don't care what shit he's done because he's a terrible person anyway, I would never vote for him. But people usually fall in one of these two places. No one is like, Birri is actually, you know, someone who represents my real political beliefs and real political agenda.
Right. And I think it's interesting as well how Basile has really repositioned himself, adopting so much of the Thawra rhetoric and really coming into this idea of, we need this systemic change. When he was one of the people, the most famous slogan during the Thawra was directed quite personally against him. He's very much in his rhetoric attempting to totally reposition both himself personally and the Free Patriotic Movement.
Definitely. If you listen to his speech, like 70% of it is inter-Christian politics, dismissing Jaja and Kataib and all of these people, Na'amat Frem, Mansour Elbon, previous allies, etc. And the other like 20-30% are divided, maybe. Most of it is just him saying exactly what we've been saying as, you know, opposition or people in the uprising or whatever. And then the other part saying the Thawra was a conspiracy and it was a big disappointment. And, you know, like it's a very interesting discourse, because Basile is saying, I apologize, but I tried. And he's saying, when you tried to do the Thawra, you were doing things wrong. And you need to do things right by supporting people who actually have the expertise and the presence in the state and the strength, etc., to implement these reforms. So he's trying to say everything you've been demanding is on our agenda. So he's trying to co-opt all of the Thawra demands, and then he follows it up by saying, you know, what were you thinking anyway? Literally, this is what he said in his speech. What were you thinking anyway? Were you thinking that through burning things in the streets, you can achieve a better country or a forensic audit or protecting depositors? You know, trying to reduce what it means to be revolting because, you know, it's fundamentally against his political mindset and political interests, but at the same time, literally taking almost every talking point from them.
And interestingly enough, I probably to a greater degree than anyone else, Basile apologized, actually said, hey, no, actually, I was kind of part of the problem and I'm sorry about that.
It's an apology that doesn't make sense because he's saying, I apologize for trying in a way. However, and although all of his speech was makhalluna, like they didn't let us do anything, he did say at certain points like, I apologize to women because they're not represented on our list. All of FPM's list has what, like one female candidate maybe?
Nada Bustani, who is seen as basically she'll do whatever Gibran says.
Yeah, one woman among all of these candidates. And so he apologized for that. He also apologized to youth for not representing them, saying that he's hoping next time someone can run in his place or in this old generation's place, etc. But mostly, in terms of political responsibility, he was saying, we tried, sorry that we weren't able to do it, but it's completely not our fault. It's the fault of those who were obstructing us as we tried to do everything right. And here, I just want to say one thing before we kind of move on. He goes on this rant, very powerful speech he was giving, against the party of the banks, as if Brahim Kanaan is not associated with the Free Patriotic Movement. He was mobilizing against Riyad Salemi like never before. He was saying, we will remove Riyad Salemi, like as one of his major punchlines in the speech. All of these things, talking about this financial, corrupt financial elite that has been entrenched in the country for 30 years. All of these are quotes. And then he's like, and we have been fighting them and we've been trying to do the right thing. But the main FPM guy in parliament and the hardest working FPM guy in parliament has been literally a representative of bank interests in parliament. So it's absolutely crazy for someone who's following parliament news and seeing what Brahim Kanaan has been doing as the VP of the Free Patriotic Movement to see this like this discourse from Basile blaming the financial elite and its interests.
Right. It goes to show that, you know, the FPM does have a diversity of interests still.
Yeah, and it also shows that politics is dead, which is my motto for this period of time. With everything we're seeing, like you can stand on stage and standing next to your candidate who is the bank's representative in parliament and go on this rant against the banks. You can do that. Everything, you know, you can do a lot of things when the standards for political discourse and political coherence is so low.
Right. Okay, so we have this sort of spectrum of diagnoses of what the problem is. Is it Hezbollah? Is it the banks? Is it corruption? Or is there a deeper issue that needs to be addressed within the Lebanese system, both politically and economically? And we see how this leads to certain electoral alliances, sort of going back to, you know, last episode when we were talking about who is running with who and where. Well, here in the discourse, we see these strands, the sovereigntists saying Hezbollah is the big problem in the country, for instance. Well, they actually are tending to align quite a bit, obviously not completely on their electoral lists, but it's something that's almost reminiscent of, you know, March 14th. Like, is March 14th back? Because we do have these electoral alliances between, you know, the LF and, say, certain members of the Mustaqbal movement who resigned and decided to run again, Boutros Harab and Kataib, another natural alliance that we see along with Michel Mouawad up in North 3, right? So the rhetoric also shows that, okay, these movements see the problem the same way, and also they've aligned their lists in a way that reflects that.
Yeah, and when they're talking about these alliances, they mention these words. So the idea of Al-Quwa Siyadiyya, the sovereigntists or whatever, was created actively, consciously, by some political actors in the last couple of years to say Opposition in Lebanon is divided. Those who recognize that Hezbollah is a problem and those who are blind to it. Obviously, this is not the reality because the people who disagree with the March 14 opposition current, like Muawad, Kataeb, etc., are not blind to Hezbollah's responsibility in the problems we have today or the main role it has in protecting the system and all of these things. It's about how you frame, as we were saying, the situation. Is it Hezbollah's control and dominance that made the state corrupt and useless, or are they both symptoms of the same problem? And this is where discourses diverge. But it's important here to kind of like think about like how different actors justify their political alliances based on how they frame the problem. So if your problem is Hezbollah, then definitely you can justify an alliance with Hezbollah's enemies, you know. Maybe not,
it makes
with,
sense.
Maybe
yeah.
not with Jaja because you don't want to lose some more like pro FPM people who might vote for you or people who don't like Jaja. But with Kataeb, sure. With Naamat Frem, sure. With Michel Maouad, Majd Harb, sure. All of these people are at the heart of the establishment and the Lebanese system. These are families that were involved in the structure, the construction of the Lebanese system or its reproduction and everything. But now they're being accepted because they are sovereignists, so quote unquote, which is like, okay, they see Hezbollah and they talk about it as a problem. And so the only two people now who have to justify their electoral alliances are, on one hand, the FPM, the Free Patriotic Movement, because it has been rallying people against Birri and saying all of these things about him. And even Jibran Basile announcing in a press conference like a few months ago that he's not in this long-term alliance with Hezbollah anymore. It's been shaken up by Hezbollah's insistence on protecting Birri at all costs and refusing to accept reforms because Birri doesn't want them. So in that sense, Basile has been talking about his aligning with Hezbollah as being on the same in the same wagon on a train, but then each of you going in a different direction after you arrive to your station or your destination. And he's saying, like, we see things differently. Our politics are different. Each of us has his own window in this wagon on the train. And that's why when we arrive, we will each take our directions. But we have to be together now because this is the electoral system in Lebanon.
And can I just make a point here about the electoral law? Something that we've discussed before, but I think it bears repeating at this moment. And that is, just because you are on the same electoral list in Lebanon does not make you an ally. In fact, the way that the law is designed, or the effects of the law, at very least, I'm not sure whether the designers had this in mind, is that when you're on a list with somebody else as a candidate, they're your enemy, because if they get a higher share of the Sotafdili, the preferential vote, then they're going to get whatever seat before you do. It serves to disunify lists quite a bit. And that's why some people will say that just because we are on the same list as these people, it doesn't mean that we're actually allied with them or that we agree with them. If you recall, in the 2018 election, Mejid Harb's father, Boutros Harb, was allied with Sleyman Frangieh. And that was a purely tactical alliance. One side is going to benefit, one side's going to lose from it. It's sort of a gamble when you go into one of these situations. But when you do that, you're just gambling that, okay, no, their votes are going to help me, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the a flip side of this as well, just because you're on separate lists doesn't necessarily mean that you're really against each other. So you used an example a few minutes ago. Some people might not want to fully ally, say, with the LF because of historical associations, or, well, Kataeb seems like, you know, they stand for a lot of the same things, so you can ally with them. And then you can have a separate LF list and Kataeb list, and maybe a few from the first list will win and a few from the second list will win. And it actually increases your chances, potentially, depending on the electorate, of winning more seats overall for this, you know, sovereigntist movement.
Yeah, and a lot of people are even mentioning how to tactically defeat this March 8 coalition. This is like the majority. Now that we're hearing this word a lot recently, the al-aktariya, how to defeat the majority in parliament. Meaning that there is a majority of Hezbollah and its allies, and we need to break their majority in parliament by basically coming together with the sovereigntists. In tactical voting, sometimes this means that, as you were saying, you would be collaborating with opponent lists on a common enemy. Like, for example, what's happening in Batroun, this very indirect, implied kind of coordination between the LF list and the March 14 opposition list, like Mawad and Harb and these people, to defeat Jibran Basil and Batroun. They're seen as a common enemy. And don't forget that Kata'ib, Mawad, Harb, LF, all of these people have a clear positioning in the global conflict between, you know, the West and Europe and the Gulf and Hezbollah and Iran and its allies.
It's 100%.
Joining like whatever anti-Hezbollah conference like Sami Jmayil did with very right-wing people in the US, going and meeting with all of these right-wing European or getting support from right-wing European groups, institutions. It's not even a question whether... All right. Banadura, nice. I like Banadura.
For a second, I thought he said hallelujah.
Hallelujah, Banadura. So yeah, it's not like one of them is like against these regional dynamics and the other is involved in them. Arguably, the least supported or endorsed political actor today by any foreign actor is Basil, because he's neither trusted or on great terms with Iran and Syrian regime, because he's trying to take distance from them. And he's under American sanctions and he's completely rejected by Gulf countries. So not trying to say there is a global conspiracy against Basil, but this is what's happening. Like what's happening.
He's very isolated at the moment. Yeah.
FPM is being isolated as much as possible. And this is simply just a political reading of the situation, guys. We don't care if you like FPM or not in this situation. We're just saying the balance of forces have switched. People who had money, who used to be with the FPM, are no longer with them. Like Naamat Frem, like Mansour Lbon, like Michel Daher, like all of these people who ran on FPM lists in order to get the parliament, and Basil was criticizing them heavily in this latest speech, have turned against him. So there's a section of the local Lebanese bourgeoisie that turns against him. There's a huge section of the diaspora bourgeoisie that turned against him. And in general, the FPM is being isolated, including by foreign actors. So it's like... There's this very strong Christian kind of momentum to khalas, defeat Basil once and for all, and you know, have all of the Christian representation be on one political line or closer to the political line of March 14, modern West Christians against primitive Hezbollah. Really, this is at stake at this moment right now, and it's a discourse battle. It's as real as ever,
and it's within this environment where Basil sort of has his back up against the wall. All of these people are against him, including, you know, most of the components of the system, that he's gone into this deeper critique of that system and say, no, things really do have to change. So we've talked about the problem, how different political movements see that problem, and there is this huge variety there, and then also how this plays into their electoral alliances. But we haven't talked about these solutions yet. And I think that's the missing component here of what we need to talk about. If we're talking about rhetoric and especially elections, you know, what are people promising? What are they saying is the right solution to all of this? And that's highly dependent on how they see themselves. You know, what is the problem? What is their role in relation to the problem? Are they part of the problem? Or are they completely outside of it? How are they outside of it? And then that naturally gives you these solutions. So you have some parties that don't propose very radical change at all. So Hezbollah, for instance, their electoral slogan is still protecting and building. And this plays into sort of how they see things and the image that they're trying to project and what the solution is. Essentially, my reading of what I've seen Hezbollah figures say and people close to Hezbollah say is their argument is, hey, look, we have provided protection, stability, and we will continue to do that. Trust us. Yes, we do know that there are problems, but we are the party pushing for your rights to continue to allow you to enjoy at least some measure of stability, even though we're all going through this very tough time right now.
Yeah, this stands in contrast a bit with Hezbollah's usual discourse, which is we are the agents of an impossible fight and we will win it. Now this is Basil's discourse. for the elections and for Lebanese politics. Hezbollah's discourse is like, we're the reasonable side here.
We're the grown-ups.
Yeah, we're the grown-ups. We don't care about this or that ministry so much like Nabih Berri does. And we're more interested in generally protecting the resistance and making sure the country works well and there's no corruption and all of these things. Yeah, you know, you gotta vote for us because who else are you gonna vote for? The enemies of the resistance? I mean, come on, can we grow up? Vote for us and then we will see. We will let you know when things can change. No high expectations, basically. Lowering expectations is one of Hezbollah's main strategies.
Right, they do have a bill, I believe, for the depositors that they've put forward, that their bloc in parliament's put forward. So they have that, so they are moving forward. They could say, okay, look at us. We are moving forward on this corruption file, on the file of the financial collapse, all of that. Just stick with us and we will make sure that things don't go to complete shit.
One thing also related to what you're saying is how parties increasingly focus on their performance of their MPs, which is something, by the way, that we were not used to in previous times, previous election rounds. No one was really, I mean, people used to say, we did this, we did that, etc. But no one would expect Nasrallah to be making, you know, dedicating half of a speech to tell people how we decide our MPs, why there are no youth in the MPs, another Hezbollah official saying, trying to explain why there are no women in the among the candidates, and like all of these things related to process, related to how you're doing things, are you really holding people accountable? Like no one believes that Hezbollah is fighting corruption anymore. Even Hezbollah supporters, by the way, they don't believe so. They believe that Hezbollah brings better ministers than others. But otherwise, no one is looking at Hezbollah be like, wow, what a great political performance in parliament and in cabinet.
And Hezbollah doesn't really have an interest in being seen as any more political than they need to be as well, because they don't want to be blamed for the failure of politics.
And they always resist these discourses that talk about Hezbollah trying to get 2/3 of the parliament, so you should close ranks with the March 14 people. Nasrallah said, no, not at all. We're not trying to do that. We don't want to be taking over anyone else's representation a bit more than we can chew. This is our power. These are our people. This is our legitimacy. And we deal with each actor according to their own sectarian legitimacy, in a way, rather than trying to say our political agenda or our political movement wants to dominate power in Lebanon or government in Lebanon.
However, with that, you look at the Amal movement, which is seen as, you know, completely protected by Hezbollah and winning seats probably because of the support of Hezbollah members and people who like Hezbollah, especially in the south and the Ba'a. Their slogan is hope and unity, which just says it right there, like, now stick with us.
Yeah.
Any of these things that Nabih Berri comes out and says about, you know, grand reforms and all of this stuff, everybody knows, as you were saying earlier, you know, he's been around for so long, he's an institution. Nobody really thinks that he is going to push for something radical. And so instead, the message that seems to come across from Amal is, hope and unity. Unity meaning stick with us. Mm-hmm. Like, please don't leave us.
What Berri did say, however, as opposed to Nasrallah, is don't take this for granted. Go to the polls. He was trying to activate his voters because he knows that he's in big trouble. I mean, the crowd in the event where Berri was announcing his list was a relatively very small crowd. It was too organized. It's not that spontaneous. And Berri needed to say things like, they are trying to convince you that we're winning anyway and you don't need to vote for us because who's going to win in Jnoub? It's always Amal and Hezbollah. Don't fall for that. Funnily, Berri is, although we're talking about him as the guy of just continuity and stability of the establishment and the status quo, right now he needs to make people afraid of something in order for them to actually vote for him, because otherwise they wouldn't even find the motivation to go vote for him. Especially that a lot, and I say a lot, of Hezbollah supporters that I've spoken to are completely against voting because Berri is on the same list. This is a reality, And in general, if Berri disappears soon, you will see way more people actually pronouncing this and waiting for this opportunity to say, oh, thank God, you know, like, we are just here for Hezbollah's the resistance side of things. We're not interested in what Berri has to say anymore because he's corrupt and he's whatever, you know.
Yeah. And that being said, though, just going back to Hezbollah for a second, I think we have noticed an escalation in the rhetoric of Hezbollah saying, oh, no, we've got to get out and vote. Like, this is important because they are worried as well of less support, in part because of their perceived protection and definite support for Nabi Berri.
And someone who's in a similar situation is Najib Mikati, in a sense of he's in power, he's prime minister right now, trying to be prime minister after the elections as well, I think. And then his main premise as a politician is what? Not maybe the new Rafael Hariri, because that implies coming in as a new actor and trying to bring consolidate power in your hands, etc. Mikati is like, I'm this guy who is not really fully associated with anyone, who will be able to talk with different parties in order to find a solution for our problems. We're able to get money from abroad, from the IMF or whatever. We'll be able to sit with the Americans and the French because, you know, he's a billionaire. He's very tall. And, you know, like, I'm kidding, but metaphorically, he's like this bigger than life figure. Like, I'm Mikati.
Absolutely. And he does... He's able to do that. He's positioned himself in the center. He's seen as coming from, you know, March 8th, all of this stuff, but he's really tried to move towards the center, especially, you know, sort of allying with Hariri tactically over the past couple of years and supporting Hariri so that he could legitimately make this claim and say, no, I can sit down with any of these partners. I am the one big Sunni figure in the country right now who's actually in a position to fix things. He does say that, oh, yes, there is a problem, obviously, that needs to be solved. But it seems as though his solution is, you know, obviously very technocratic. And also, hey, I'm the guy, you can trust me to actually do this and solve this because I have the ear of so many people and they will sit down with me and actually trust me. So he's taken on this role of, you know, vote for me because I'm the guy who can get things done, which is kind of parallel to Hezbollah, like vote for us. Look at our track record. We provide stability here.
Yeah, and Mikati, with the absence of Hariri and Tripoli and the North, is right now the most stable politician. If you're making your political choice based on a gamble on who's the guy who's going to last more in Sunni politics, you're probably going to go with Mikati right now. Walid Jumblat is another actor who's in this weird situation. He's been in governments for as long as we can remember, with 1, 2, 3, 4 ministers, depending on, you know, the sectarian dynamics, who's in power, all of these things. But Walid Jumblat today, his discourse is troubled because his people are, in general, almost everyone who supports the PSP and the social environment, the people around them, they are pro, like, October uprising, you know, pro getting rid of the corruption of sectarianism and all of these things. And it's not like Jumblat is convincing them in any way through his political discourse, because there isn't, again, any consistent discourse that Jumblat has been carrying in the last many years. So, for example, Jaja, despite the very weird dynamics between him and Aoun and the FPM, Jaja is saying, we've been fighting Hezbollah's dominance for this, that amount of years, and this is why he should trust us in this fight. Jumblat cannot say the same, because he's been on and off with Hezbollah in this last decade or decade and a half. He's in power, but he's not really in control. He doesn't benefit from changing the system away from sectarianism, because anyway, he's not going to get more representation. Walid Jumblat today, as the primary zaim of the Druze, gets the maximum he can get in power, because he's determining who are the Druze ministers and who are the Druze cabinet members to a great extent, with the exception of Talal Islan jumping in.
And he feels in this election like the walls are closing in on him, like they're coming for Mukhtar. Like,
which is exactly what he said last time, just to be clear. Well, Jumblat last time felt that there was an issue with not enough people voting for him. And he preemptively He went down in the last couple of days before the elections, touring in these villages and saying, we are under siege, they want to take away our political house, they want to, you know, shut us down, etc., eliminate our history, trying to sell our the Druze community to Hezbollah, whatever it is. Like last time, it was mostly against the FPM and Basile. Maybe this time, because people are not seeing the FPM so much as the big, you know, enemy anymore, it's more like Hezbollah after what we've been talking about. Since the October uprising, etc. So people still hate Basile so much, but they're more realigning with their March 14 position. We and the LF fighting Hezbollah's dominance and expansion into our areas.
And I think you see Jumblatt's positioning reflected a bit in their slogan.
The voice of reason, the will of tomorrow.
So tell me if my reading of this is right. The first half of that to me seems like the voice of reason, that's Jumblatt. Like, and the house of Jumblatt, hey, we've been around for this long, we cannot fall. Will of tomorrow is saying, we're going to adapt to the new circumstances. You know, you can trust us to change with the times and be there for you, despite all of the craziness that's gone on. Is that accurate?
I think so. Al-Aql, Sawt Al-Aql, it's a very Druze thing as well, because Al-Aql has a lot of philosophical connotations in the Druze religion, which also is used in Sheikh Al-Aql, who is the head religious authority for the Druze in Lebanon. And, you know, it's a word that has a certain value, maybe for a certain audience.
Or a traditional leaning. And by the way, Al, that's what we translated as reason, voice of reason, that first part of his slogan.
Exactly. And what this answers to is the chaos, the ideological vacuum, the political chaos, the confusion, the fear, the anxiety. Don't worry, there's a voice of wisdom and reason who's here for you, you know, taking up a politically patriarchal position. I am responsible for you, but I know what I'm doing. It's a kind of a trademark of Jumblatt discourse in general to say that while we are not perfect, we are reasonable people who are trying to protect this community's interests. Voice of tomorrow is just to say, Taimur, not Walid, young man, new dreams, new blood, new first names, as you're saying. So these are Jumblatt, Miqati, Amal, Hezbollah. These are the actors who are in power or, you know, trying to remain so, trying to remain valid, relevant, and bring back people's trust in them. But you have more interesting actors. Are the new actors? Are you emerging actors who are trying to say, we are the alternative, vote for us, instead of the people in power? And in general, again, same with seeing the problem and framing the problem. In terms of the solution, you also have a very similar kind of categorization of different discourses, right? There's one that focuses, again, generally on bad, incompetent people in power that should be changed. New faces, new blood will fix the situation because an MP works for their people and not only for the clientelist interest, because this and this and that, just basic rule of law, state of institutions, no corruption, modern state, meritocracy. All of these things that don't classify you anywhere politically, because they are self-evident things kind of about any modern society.
Right. If only we got people in there who were pure of heart, they certainly would never get corrupted by the system around them. They would change the system. This idea.
And these are the discourses that usually increase expectations ahead of the elections. Sawtak bi'arrir. Will you leave the country or will you stay? Your voice is kind of this very strong, powerful tool that you can use today. Jaja is basing his discourse on this idea. Don't lose hope. If you make the right political choice today in the elections, you can actually change the course of the country. And then after this, like, kind of basic, the most basic discourse, which is, to be fair, the discourse of a lot of oppositionists in Lebanon, opposition candidates, especially when people who are brought together on a specific list are not brought together by very strong political conviction. So this is very common discourse, but then the emerging discourse that we were talking about earlier, which focuses only on Hezbollah, has a different proposition. It says, we first take away Hezbollah's weapons and achieve real sovereignty, and then we can fix the economy, the political system, whatever is wrong. Because in the current situation, there's an imbalance of power and we cannot agree with Hezbollah on what's coming next if Hezbollah is always blackmailing us with their weapons. This is the kind of the second, the more sovereigntist kind of discourse. The weird part about this discourse is that if Hezbollah's dominance is the problem, then how come all of Hezbollah's political opponents, when they were in power and when they were sharing power with Hezbollah, neither of them could really like achieve anything? So, you know, no one in Lebanon is deceived to an extent, apart from people who work in Washington, D.C. and think that they can frame a new reality for us in Lebanon. No one believes that Hariri and Jumblatt and Jaja are people who are trying to do things, but oh my God, Hezbollah didn't let them. And if you think the problem in Lebanon is not an economic or financial crisis, it's just a political crisis related to Iran's dominance, this is not the reality. We know in Lebanon that there is a structure, an economic model related to certain vested interests that has been built to govern the country, to dominate political discourse, to divide people along sectarian lines. But it's a system. It's a system that is deeply flawed, that is deeply unfair. And this is what caused the current situation. And it's not like one actor.
Right. And in the very extreme case of this rhetoric, not saying that everybody who's a sovereigntist goes along with this, but the extreme form of the rhetoric is, you know, we absolutely can't do anything until we solve Hezbollah's weapons, that problem. Well, that sounds kind of like you're just using an excuse not to do anything on the financial front, on other actual reforms. Yeah, you may talk a good game about reforms and economic reforms and productive economies. And
my bigger problem then, it sounds like an excuse, because sometimes it can be, you know, it can be in the sense of, okay, as long as there is this armed presence, I cannot do anything and I'm clear about it, etc. You know, it can be like a reasonable political discourse. The problem is that none of these people who spend most of their time identifying themselves as sovereigntist anti-Hezbollah people propose a clear way in which they will deal with the situation of Hezbollah's weapons. Because everyone, Sami Jmail, before the elections time started, few months ago, was saying, okay, everyone's talking about Hezbollah, okay, what are you going to really do about it? You're going to sit with them, negotiate with them, and agree with them on a solution, right or wrong? So if Jaja wants to sell us that he's more anti-Hezbollah than we are, yeah, bullshit, what are you going to really do about it? You're just saying that to gain political representation and to become the largest Christian party, which is totally true. In the case of Jaja, this is exactly what he wants. He wants to be the largest Christian party and to become kind of in this position where he represents Christian in the political system, gets representation in the states, power, etc., and follow whatever political agenda he has. So Jmail was saying we should be more honest, we should be more reasonable, and we should not try to deceive people by telling them, if you vote for us, we will fix this Hezbollah thing first, because it's the hardest thing to fix. But Jmail entering the election is a different one, when he's like, oh, we don't accept opposition that is not sovereigntist. If you're not subscribing to this sovereigntist idea that it's all about taking away Hezbollah's weapons first, therefore you're different from us. And they created this sovereigntist kind of line within the Mu'arada because so many actors were already flirting with the idea of creating this kind of March 14 coalition or alliance among opposition and old establishment groups such as Jmail, Mu'awad, etc. And this is the current reality. And political money that we talked about last episode is also interesting in this situation, because it comes in and says, yes, unite all together. We don't care if his name is Jmail or Frem or Mu'awad or whatever. We need modern liberals who can build a modern liberal state away from Hezbollah's dominance.
And another thread that we see running through a lot of sovereigntist sides, especially LF, Kataib, is just, you know, very much an acceptance of capitalism and neoliberal policies as well.
100%. We're talking about people like Samir Saliba, talking about Kataib, both of which quite on the neoliberal side. I mean, I'm not talking about slogans, oh, we're a social democratic party. I'm talking about like real policies and real behavior in parliament and in terms of like their political positioning, real connections. Kataib is, you know, running with Antoun Zahnawi, as we were saying last week. So it cannot be really a representative. I mean, it cannot be really fighting banks' interest in parliament if it's through banks' money that it got to parliament, which is will be the case for Nadeem Jmail. So, yeah, I mean, these people are completely on the neoliberal side of things, on the, you know, whatever the IMF says, less corruption, cleaner form of capitalism. and give me some like social protection net, you know, safety net for people who are too poor, who cannot even like get a good education and get a job and do achieve the American dream. Maybe these people can get like some cash, you know, some free healthcare, etc. This idea that it's not economic rights, it's like just supporting you when you're in need, is not like welfare state idea like you have in many Western European countries. No, it's a neoliberal idea that is trying to minimize as much as possible how much you're spending, as opposed to try to ensure these economic and social rights for as many people as possible. For example, are you for a universal public healthcare system, or are you for quote-unquote universal coverage, mostly through private entities that are making profits on your insurance and all of this? You know, you see it, you're an American citizen, you know the healthcare system in the United States and how much debate there is around how to organize it. You know, in Lebanon right now, when I keep saying politics is dead, because really, like, people are just saying random things. Like Layal Boumoussa went kind of viral for saying, I am pro-free market economically, I am right-wing economically, but I am left-wing in terms of social justice and universal healthcare. And no one in the history of economic policy and political economy will ever be able to understand this notion, because free market economy and universal healthcare are, as you know, as contradictory as it gets.
Right. And I want to point out that this embrace of, you know, neoliberal policies as well, that's nothing. There's no systemic critique. If you look at the actual platforms, you will see a lot of ideas thrown out there, but none of them would actually hit at changing the system of Lebanon itself. The house needs a new coat of paint, but the foundation's fine.
Yeah, and mostly because of sectarian concerns and demographic concerns, a lot of this talk about systemic change is avoided. And one thing to note here is that Jaja, during his election speech, said, I'm warning people, and I've warned ambassadors about this, don't try to talk about systemic change in Lebanon today, because people are not worried about the system. People are worried about their food and their money. Well, Mr. Samir Jaja, what brings food to the table? Isn't it the economy and how it functions? Isn't it how much imbalance and deficit you're in that causes your economy to reach a point where it collapses and people don't have purchasing power anymore? Isn't it the economic model and the monetary policy that you supported over long years when Riyad Salemi was doing all of this financial engineering? You were praising him when he did the financial engineering in 2016. One of the main reasons why we're reaching up to this point is all of this accumulation of bad policies. It's always like this disconnection between the politics and the economic is something that liberals and neoliberals do a lot. And it's always very tricky, because the idea that the economy is a technical thing that can be fixed by experts, while all you need to worry about is if you are with abortion or not, or if you are with Iran or not, you know, everything else is politics. But the economic side of things, leave it to the expert, you know. We'll outsource the airport to some multinational company, which was exactly what Jaja said. Put all of state assets in this fund that will make profits in some way and pay back the banks the debts that they are owed by the state, which is the bank's official proposal, but also supported by people like Kataib and others in different forms, and people like the FPM or even the LF. So all of the elite, including opposition and Sulta, who are in this neoliberal direction or fall in this camp, are going to be most likely supporting the same kind of economic policies after the elections. You know, what is it really about? Is it about what you say and your intentions and who you are and what your identity is? Or is it about what interests you represent, especially in times of a material crisis like we have today?
Yeah, and this stands in contrast, it seems, at least at first glance, with the FPM and Basile and President Aoun going after the banking system, going after Riyad Salemi in their rhetoric, at very least.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the Lebanese economic model, the banks really are at the heart of it. And clearly something is going to happen, right? Because all of the banks are underwater at this point, including the central bank. In the rhetoric, we see Gibran Basile very much bringing this forward, President Aoun very much bringing this forward and attacking Riyad Salemi and high-ranking bankers, etc. Although I'm unsure, at least on the economic side of things, how much they would actually want to change that system, or whether it's more a case of, you know, we talked about changing faces in Parliament, or do they just want to change the faces in the banking system and not have any deeper structural changes?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how the FAM will take it after the elections, because right now they're talking about systemic change. They're talking about building a civil state. You feel, you know, conflicted. Like, I don't understand. This is like the party that has been talking, using the probably the most sectarian discourse in the country for the last couple of decades. Like, all of these different words used by the FAM, terminology, frameworks, that are clearly sectarian in basis. Also, the big focus on the refugees and how the refugees are the biggest threat to Lebanon and all of these things are still in the discourse today. So when you listen to FAM's discourse, you find a lot of liberal policy items, so many, it's ridiculous. Like, it's almost like it's a laundry list of liberal policies. And you have, like, the more socialist energy in there saying things like protecting small depositors, making banks pay, preventing them from being in parliament, the banks and the sector, etc., removing Riyad Salameh, doing this and that. These are left-wing talking points that developed in the uprising and are now also part of the FPM discourse. So, in a sense, each party, maybe each actor, needs to find these different tools in rhetoric and discourse in order to make a certain combination, a certain package that meets their political moment. But, you know, just for the sake of mentioning it, Jubran Basile is suggesting electing the president over two rounds, for example, changing it to a bit of a presidential, half-presidential system.
And when you say electing, you mean people.
Yeah.
Actually, not as the current system is just the 128 MPs or however many people in parliament go in and vote for it.
Exactly. Having a direct presidential election is one of the things that he was talking about. The civil state, meaning civil marriage, civil person status law, etc. Also creating a Senate. All of these, by the way, are typical items, you know, except for the presidential part. This is nothing new. The Senate and all of these policies that were in the Taif agreement and have been talked about by a lot of politicians since then. Among the opposition, you've also find most of the proposals when it comes to sectarianism are also falling along the exact same lines. Don't think that there is a big difference in rhetoric. Some groups go assertive in taking a specific notion that they focus on. For example, some people say it's about decentralization. And here it's so tricky because some people are saying decentralization is important for development and democracy. And other people are saying decentralization in the sense of sectarian federalism. We want to have our own cultural rules. Let them have their own. We want to be associated with the countries that are friends to us. Let them be associated with their own. Dividing Lebanon into dividing the already miniature country into many different parts and each of them with a different foreign policy and social policy, which is absolutely crazy, but it exists as a line of discourse today.
Yeah, and it's gotten bigger over the past 5 years or so. Absolutely. But I think that's something for, like, we could talk about federalism for like an entire podcast or two. It's a whole different can of worms. But yeah, things like electing the president directly, like that would be a huge systemic change. Now, of course, Basile's saying this, what's to say 10 years from now he won't come back and say, oh, Mahaluna. That's that's another question. He is saying this, and he is actually proposing things that would change the nature of Lebanon, the politics of Lebanon.
Yeah, at the level of discourse, at least. There is some recognition that the old is dying and is not functional and we need something new. This recognition in itself is kind of a new thing for FPM, because this was actually their original position when they came to Lebanon back in 2005. I remember all the talk about secularism, all the talk about reforming the state away from these notions of sectarianism and sectarian power sharing. And then it became kind of the party that represents sectarian power sharing because of how hard it's been fighting for every Christian ministry and every Christian post in the state and all of that. So the FPM kind of went on this trip, on this ego trip, you know, like becoming as powerful as you can in this bullshit system, and then realizing, oh, this system is bullshit, so vote for us so that we change it. You know, it's quite a proposal, quite a demand, you know, vote for us so that we change what we've been ruling over and benefiting from for a long time, and, you know, sending our guys to different places to work in this institution, make money out of that contract, whatever, and then suddenly, like, oh, shit, it doesn't work. So let's be the leaders of the new Lebanon that we should build. It's a hard sell, We don't know if it's gonna. It's all about the results now. It's really hard to predict, and I don't trust opinion polls so much. We have to wait and see how the FPM base responds to this line of discourse. But what's definitely happening is a conversation more than before around the nature of the Lebanese system, of the Lebanese economy, even to a lesser extent than I would want to see. But this is a conversation today. And we see, for example, among the opposition, if we forget about Basile for a second, we see like a big, big debate surrounding the strategy of change. You know, like, how do we achieve change? And are we really trying to change the rulers or change the system, the faces or the structures?
Yeah, I feel like this has been a continuing theme throughout this episode. Does Lebanon just slap on a new coat of paint? Does it just change the faces at the top? Or are there deeper structural issues that really do need to get reworked? And as we see, most of the Sulta powers don't seem, at least in their rhetoric and what they're proposing, to be getting into very deep structural changes. But we do have a bit with the FPM. And then, as you're saying, with the opposition groups, it's actually a much bigger discussion.
Yeah, it's the discussion right now. And I mean, even when it's not pronounced explicitly, it's the basis of a lot of conflicts that are happening. I'm going to say it exactly how I think about it, because I am part of this conversation and I'm not trying to isolate myself from it. What I usually say is, it's not about the face, it's not about the individual, their personality, because it's about what they represent in two ways. One way is what interests they represent today, what material interests in society they represent, and in the other side of it, what political phenomenon they represent. Are they a potential zaim? Are they a potential large sectarian party, like the Kata'ab, for example? Potential zaim, like Mu'awad or Jumayil or Na'amat Frem? Are they a grassroots movement? Are they an organized political party, like Sharm el-Nahas party, like trying to say what's distinguishing us from others is how institutional and organized we are? You know, there are many different, you know, types of actors, and you always need to be like cautious around which actors are giving power or legitimacy in transitionary times, because these are the ones that will be most relevant in the new Lebanon, if there's a new Lebanon. You know what I mean? This is why the situation today is so tricky. The division among the opposition voices is very drastic. The polarization is quite strong today. For example, I've received a lot of messages from people saying, "We're very disappointed in you. Why are you attacking the opposition all the time? Don't you worry about the Sulta? Like, did you lose your political compass?" And I'm like, guys, do you think I'm like absolutely crazy and don't understand that Jaja and Nasrallah and Aoun and Jumblat and Birri are the real problem? Like, of course I do. Like, are you crazy? No, this is not the discussion. The discussion is, when you're making a political choice, there's a lens through which you see the world, okay? It's the basis of your ideology. It's how you see things, how you see the problem, how you see the solution. So, of course, if someone is telling you, "I'm aligning with Antoun Sahnawi," I'm not going to be like, "Oh, join our list, be our ally." Of course not, because I know that my interests, my mother's saving account, which she was relying on for her retirement, was stolen by Antoun Sahnawi to be given to Nadim Jmail to run for the elections. No, you know, I would not accept that. Antoun Sahnawi decided, "I'm going to confiscate this money." And then he's decided, "Okay, I'm going to fund 6-7 candidates across the country. And one of them is Nadim Jmail, one of the primary figures in the Kata'ab party because of his family name. Also one that Sami Jmail and Kata'ab party never want to let go of." So, you know, make up your mind. If you're opposition, you cannot be representing the interests of those who are currently ruining the economic situation. Like, have been benefiting from how terrible the economic and financial system and the schemes employed are. So, no, you have to make up your mind. And it's not the problem of those who reject Kata'ab or Mu'awad or whatever opportunist who wants to say, "Oh, I happen to have money, I happen to be a large businessman, and I happen to be funding these elections out of my own money, probably violating the law 20 times over, but I'm an opposition because I'm against the ruling establishment, the corrupt establishment." So Na'amat Frem didn't know in 2018 that there was a corrupt establishment. He was like so confused about it. He was like, "Oh, maybe Basile is this new guy who's trying to change the world." Of course not. Like, don't sell us bullshit. Don't sell us illusions. Talk to us as grown-ups who have Have solid and like reasonable opinions, and then we can have a proper conversation about strategy. Right now, it's all about, you know, you're the traitor, you hate us, you hate opposition, you just want the interests of the Sultan, and all of this bullshit talk that doesn't get you anywhere. After the election, it will be like, oh my God, we need to learn from our lessons. Yeah, that's the point. The point is to make less political mistakes that you have to learn from, and to learn from whatever you do.
Nizar, why don't you tell us how you really feel? That was quite a rant. But I totally see this point. At the same time, however, I don't think that these people in power, at least a lot of them, part of the Sulta, they're not dumb. they're not idiots. They know, okay. And I also think that a lot of them have good intentions. As in, they think that they are doing what is right based on their worldview, how they assess the problem and what the potential solutions are. And so they will accept a certain amount of, oh, I've got to get my hands dirty here and there in order for this like greater good to come about, you know, later down the road. To a degree, I think all politicians have to play this game. Right. You do have to get your hands a little bit dirty. Not saying you have to run a corrupt empire or anything like that, but there are trade-offs for sure. And so I guess I could see sort of both sides. I can understand, honestly, why some people would say, oh, no, I'm voting for this guy. Yeah, he's Sulta, but I know what his strategy is here and I agree with it, even if he's taking money from some banker in order to get this done.
Yeah, it depends on what someone sees as the political priority at the end. But as long as it's not empty of any nuance, it's a healthy debate to have, like pragmatism.
Absolutely.
Versus like, you know, revolutionary politics versus, you know.
But I do think at the same time, you have to be clear-eyed about it. Just because some politician is saying, oh, I'm going to, you know, I really am working for the good and for the right. No, you have to actually scrutinize their program, what they actually want to change. Do they actually want to make the changes that align with your interests or not?
And the record.
Absolutely.
Who were their ministers? What did they do? What positions they took on different occasions? Were they part of the parliamentary fact-seeking committee, which is like the biggest scandal in political history or not? You know, like a lot of criteria you can find for judging whether someone is on your side or not. As long as it's not just like pure emotional bias, like, yeah, I prefer a modern, like, West-oriented Lebanon over, you know, a more Islamic Lebanon. This is not what's at stake, you know? These people are ruling together or competing in politics, but eventually they are fighting in the political arena and not, like, the you know, the cultural arena. And you should know the difference between the two in terms of no one is trying to tell you that you have to follow Sharia and no one is trying to tell you that we will ally with Israel. Like, all of the... Both of these talking points are wrong. Maybe one of the political actors today, like Jaja, might in the future come out and say, yes, normalization with Israel now or whatever. I expect this, and I expect it from other people as well who are not right now, maybe suspected of that. But this is not what's at stake now. And for the Hezbollah camp and the... Some people are left-wing but close to the Hezbollah camp and they buy into all of these talking points. It's all about this principle struggle between imperialism and the anti-imperialist force. Yes, okay. I understand this framework for you, but you are talking about real people in a real country today who are struggling from deep injustices because of reasons related to the structures of political economy and politics in the country. Okay, so if you are pro-imperialist or anti-imperialist, you know, it's very important for many things. But I want to know how you're linking that to voting for Hezbollah and Birri and FPM in the elections, or, you know, hating anyone who's not pro-Hezbollah, or, you know, bullying anyone who's not pro-Hezbollah. Like, this is the reality of the society today. People are afraid of many things. Some people are afraid of Hezbollah because of how much political propaganda there is. Some people are afraid of Hezbollah because of their own experience with it, in Sabah Ayyar or other incidences. So yeah, it's reality. But if we frame everything as a conflict around that, then politics will be like so far off from the real interests of people.
And that's why it's so important to not just take rhetoric at face value, but actually dive into it. And hopefully we've been able to, you know, give you guys a bit of a taste, at least of how we analyze this rhetoric in this episode and, you know, what it tells at least us about how these different factions see themselves, see the problem, see the world, see their opposition. Because yeah, in any election, rhetoric is going to go to an extreme, right? Because you're trying to win, and desperate times call for desperate measures, and a lot of half-truths start coming out. Whether you're sulta or opposition, this is just the nature of politics, of electoral politics. I think really the bottom line on all of this is look past the rhetoric and try to figure out why these parties, why these figures are saying what they're saying. And does that align with my values and how I see the world?
And what are they really going to do after the election? And does that serve my interest, you know? If people answer both of these questions, I think it would be hard to make a terrible political choice.
And, yeah.
You know, it's confusing. It's a confusing time. No one wishes that politics is so chaotic and all over the place. I'm hopeful that in the next election, the opposition would be way more institutionalized, way more kind of serious, and you would see like two main fronts, for example, one with a clear political message and another one with another one. Right now, it's not the situation at all. It's still kind of these old civil society dynamics of who wants to run where and who gets together with who. And there's like this model across all districts alongside a relatively weak party, which is Sharbana Has party, saying, no, we talk about programs and not individuals, so vote for us across the country. There's no convergence between two yet. So there isn't any political party that is saying, I've formed all of these serious, smart political alliances across the country on the basis of my program. Because those who are focusing on the program are terrible at alliances, and those who are good at alliances are more interested in the new faces and the new blood ideology rather than systemic change.
Yeah. Well, I think we need to leave it there.
Yeah, it's been like 2 hours and a half.
I don't know. Have fun editing. Yeah, I think we need to leave it there. We will be back next week for our last episode before the elections. And boy, I have a feeling we're going to have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, exciting.
It's getting there. It's already voting. Voting is happening now. The elections are upon us, literally. So yeah, tune in next week for this last podcast before the elections. And until then, I'm Benjamin Red.
I'm Nizar Hassan.
And this has been the Lebanese Politics Podcast. The Lebanese Politics Podcast is brought to you by me, Benjamin Red, Nizar Hassan, who also produces it, and the music was by Omar Alfil.